So at this point, this was like one bug. It could be critical already, like one of the team members found it and filled it as is. But there was like way more to achieve. And my mind like said, okay, let's see how many users are in the organization. We wanted to pre-vesc, right? So what's the best common way to pre-vesc from this environment? Let's find stale accounts, you know, dead accounts, maybe with expired emails. That was my thinking. Enumerating, I managed to fetch all the users. There were over 200K accounts on that environment.
Oh my God, you're kidding me. Up, y'all, before we hop into this episode, two quick things. One, we intended to do some giveaways on this episode, but then we forgot completely to integrate it into the episode in any way, shape, or form. So we're going to make it easy for you guys. Just head over to c2pb.show/giveaway100. Obviously, giveaway and then episode 100, giveaway 100. And we're just going to make it super simple for you to enter your name there and get access to entering your name for the giveaways that we've got. We're going to give away some Kaito licenses. We're going to give away CTBB swag. We're going to give away premium Discord subs. And we're going to give away Shift AI beta access. Now that brings us to the second point. What is Shift AI beta access? Well, I'm glad you asked. We're going to talk to you more about that at length at the end of this episode after the bug that Rezo presents. But essentially, the TLDR of it is Shift is a new Kaito plugin that Joseph Thacker and I have created, and it was inspired by Cursor AI. So I'm not sure if any of you guys have used Cursor, but it's a new IDE where you can just kind of prompt in natural language what kind of app you want, and it just builds out the whole app for you. It's phenomenal. And when we saw this, we thought, wow, wouldn't it be amazing if we could bring something similar to hacking. So that's what we did. Rezo's the backend engineer for the AI stuff. I'm the front end for Kaito integration. And we built a tool that can do really cool stuff, like you can paste a JS, you know, snippet in and it will automatically generate the replay request body that's being described in that JS snippet. You can highlight a set of feature flags in the response in replay in Kaito and say, hey, add a match and replace rule for me to turn all these feature flags on, and boom, the match and replace rules right in your Kaito configuration. So it's a really great tool. We've been loving it. We're launching it. So if you're interested, head over to shiftwaitlist.com, drop your email there. So two things. ctpb.show/giveaway100 to enter the giveaways, and then shiftwaitlist.com to join the waitlist for that awesome Kaito AI plugin. All right, that's it. I've ranted enough. Let's go back to the show. All righty, man. Here we are, 100 episodes.
You know, after 100 episodes, you still jump up and down and get nervous before these things.
Dude, I do. Every episode, you got to get that energy high. You got to get that energy high. That's what the people deserve, Joel. That's what the people deserve.
Yeah.
Dude, I'm proud of us. 100 episodes. Give me some, man. Give me a fist bump through the screen right now. I'm going to mess up on my camera's focus. But, dude, as you guys, I guess, addressing the audience, as you guys have probably seen from the title, we have some announcements today with regards to Joel. And Joel, thanks so much for coming along on this journey with me, man, for the past 2 years. It's been a blast.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's been really awesome doing the podcast the last few years. You know, in terms of why I'm leaving, it's mostly just personal reasons. You know, I wasn't feeling super engaged with the pod. You may have noticed I hadn't been on episodes lately. It's just been sort of difficult for me to balance everything that I'm doing along with the podcast. So I think we decided that it would be better for me to step back, and I'll probably be on as a guest. At least I know we have one planned soon. So I'll definitely be on as a guest at some point. So I'm not going anywhere, but yeah, I will be stepping back from the pod.
Yeah, man. It's been really crazy that you've done this for 2 years in addition to full-time job in addition to Bug Bounty, right? Because in order to be able to be the co-host of this podcast, you kind of have to actively be like hacking on stuff too to get the juices flowing and the passion, you know, running, right? And for me as a full-time hunter, it's easy for me to like fit that into my schedule while doing the podcast. But, you know, even for me, the podcast takes up a bunch of time. And I couldn't imagine you having another whole 40-hour thing and trying to get hacking done and trying to do the podcast. So, dude, major props to you for hanging in there for 2 years. And
I had to get to 100, you know. Even if I was kind of like being dragged the last the last mile, it's like a marathon, hey, you know.
Man, it's me and you
got your buddy, and you're like, "Listen, we're getting over that fucking finish line, whether you like it or not."
Oh my god, dude! Shit, Joel, don't make me laugh, man. I'm gonna tear up, and I'm gonna miss this, dude. I'm gonna miss this. So, but yeah. I think it's the right choice. I think it's the right choice for you. I think it'll you know, make you feel less stressed. It'll free up time, allow you to really kind of pour back into your passions. And yeah, I mean, I think the Critical Thinking Podcast will go on. I hope.
Yeah. Hey, it has been. It has been. It's only going to keep getting better. So, yeah, I mean, I'm really excited to see what's going to, you know, keep going on with the pod. Now I get to listen to it more a listener, which is fun, instead of like being having the spoilers for every single episode. So that's fun. But yeah, dude, it's been amazing. And, you know, thanks for caring when I've been lacking. And yeah, it's been amazing.
Of course, man. Got your back always. And yeah, we'll definitely be having you on for guests and as a guest. And yeah, definitely pinging you for any mobile stuff that I need help with, as always.
Yeah, cool, man. Cool. All right. So last episode, 100th episode, not last episode, my last episode.
Yep.
We've got a little special something. Right?
We do. So, we got a lot on the docket. What we did for this one, because we wanted to bring you guys something special for the 100th episode, we reached out to, geez, how many hackers did it end up being here? Let's take a look. I think we have 8 hackers from Critical Thinking this year that have been on the pod or been friends of the pod. And we asked them, what was your favorite bug from 2024? One that you thought was creative. Doesn't necessarily have to be the most impactful, though most of them are very impactful. And we asked those hackers what... you know, about those bugs, to share those bugs with us, and they kindly did. So this episode is going to be kind of diced up a little bit. It might be a little bit choppy because we're going to be kind of jumping back and forth from the time that I recorded with these top hackers to you know, back to today where Joel and I are sort of commenting on them. As long as Joel can hang in there. Joel, I know you're sick right now, but he's bringing his A game to the last episode. So let's go ahead without further ado and jump into one of those. First up on the list is Natalie. Let's check out his bug from 2024.
Yep. So it wasn't that hard for me to pick the biggest bug of 2024 for me, because there was only one which actually required for me to do a lot of steps onto. It was also a collaboration. And it's like, now that I started working at Wiz, it was also pretty interesting to see like cloud, you know, the world is not only related to bug bounty and external stuff. You can also do a lot of stuff from the inside, which is interesting. And so we can get right into it. So this was a target which allowed to hack everything that belongs to the target. That's always good. So we start on the internet, you know, like everything is on the internet. It needs to be publicly accessible at first. Now, usually targets allow us to find anything. So you have star@travel.com. This is like the code name that we chose here. So what you do now, you know, subdomain discovery, subfinder, brute forcing, fuzzing, permutations, and so on and so on and so on. If it takes you less than 5 minutes, you're doing something wrong, because it should take you a lot more to find all those assets. And so that's on that part. So we dive deep on that. We found all the subdomains, a lot of iterations, nothing really interesting, you know, on that part. Now we don't only have DNS assets of the company under the root domain. There's a lot of cloud resources that companies use: S3 buckets, Lambdas, Azure Blobs, Google Storage, and so on and so on and so on. So, you know, these are not really affiliated with the company sometimes. You can have random naming arbitration. Like, it doesn't need to be travel.azurewebsites.com to be their asset. So there's a lot of ways and a lot of tools to find cloud resources from the outside, either references on JavaScript files from main domains, either URL scan, either Wayback Machine, either some references that redirects, you know, from different domains to cloud domains, which are not affiliated with the company, but might have data there. So that was this case. We managed to find one cloud resource, which didn't have the company inside it, but it had a redirection to a domain of the company. And on that domain, it was basically like nothing, Azure website 302 to another domain that doesn't resolve. Okay? That was pretty interesting. Like, you have a DNS, Azure website, that redirects to a domain which is dead. Okay, so something has to make it redirect, right? I mean, it doesn't just out of the blue. So it was a CO2 redirect on the client side. So whenever that happens, you have JavaScript to examine and to look at. So in this case, there were a lot of JavaScript files. Usually you'd want to look at the main.js or like the runtime. And on, yeah, if you, you can stop me if you have any questions so far.
No, I do have a question because it's like I'm seeing this and it's saying in the JS files. So were you reaching out to that specific cloud resource or like all cloud resources? And then if it's a client side redirect, how the frick are you detecting this? Are you like running all of these in like a headless browser and seeing where you end up? Like how is that happening?
Yeah, so you can use crawlers like to fetch all the static JavaScript files. And then that should give you the files already, even if you use like, I think if you just use Katana or like any industry-leading crawlers.
Yeah.
There are also several tools like URLscan and others that if you search like travel.com, it shows you all the redirections to travel.com also, like where the request originated from. So if you look at like openai.com or like the files, like I was just playing with OpenAI, I saw the file, like the save attachments on a weird domain, OAI private file, something like that. So if you look on this on URL scan, you will see all the websites that redirected you to that. So you see a lot of ChatGPT, but you also see some, you know, like cloners and phishing domains and like ChatGPT mockups that they simulate ChatGPT on their infrastructure. Then you can see the original resource. So what happened here? We searched for domain that doesn't resolve on URL scan, and then we saw an actual Azure websites asset that redirected to it. So that way you can actually find cloud resources that are not connected to the asset, which is pretty interesting.
That's super cool.
Yeah. So from that point, we had JavaScript file and it had a lot of secrets. So one of the secrets had an Azure DevOps bearer token, which was interesting to explore. And we found out in the collaboration that we can actually invite ourselves to this environment, this company, as a guest account on the tenant. So as a guest account, you have access to the Azure AD. Not much, but at least, I don't know if it's default or not, but we could query, like do enumeration and see all the groups that exist and all the users that exist just by using the Azure CLI.
I think that is default. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I think it's default because you wouldn't expect someone to do something with that. So at this point, this was like one bug. It could be critical already. Like one of the team members found it and filled it as is. But there was like way more to achieve. And my mind like said, okay, let's see how many users are in the organization. We wanted to pre-vesc, right? So what's the best common way to pre-vesc from this environment? Let's find stale accounts, you know, dead accounts, maybe with expired emails. That was my thinking. Enumerating, I managed to fetch all the users. There were over 200K accounts on that environment.
Oh my God, you're kidding me.
So all we have is their username, their permissions, like which groups they belong to, and their email addresses. So everything with like at travel.com, remove it. It's taken, you know. So like you narrow down the list, gmail.com, remove it, and so on and so on. Eventually, we got to a list of like 10,000 users that I ran like self-failed detection on them and like expired domain detection to see if we have any name server zone takeovers or we can buy them on GoDaddy. And around 50 domains were available for purchase like 100 accounts, which was pretty interesting. I mean, okay, so we have now 100 accounts that we need to examine the permissions and we can actually just get a password login. We set up the 2FA also, so like no restrictions on that. It was just a story of like, you know, if they only knew they have so many dead accounts for like 5 years of some consulting companies they use, you know, if you look at the cloud a little bit from the inside, if you only saw a user that now we took over an account and it wasn't active for 6 years and now it's playing around. I mean, you know, some light bulbs should build now. I don't know how you say it. I mean, it should spark maybe.
Yeah.
On that moment.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's crazy too, you know, like if you're issuing accounts, like AD accounts to like contractors, like you said, like that contracting company can just do like a rebrand or something. And now their domain is up for grabs. And that leads to that specific vulnerability. So you really need to have a good grip on AD, I guess, hygiene in these sort of massive company environments, I think.
Yeah, I don't know how common. I think it's pretty common to invite guests or like contractors to your AD because, you know, you don't want to play with, like, it's Okta or it's Azure AD. It's all about permissions. You don't want to mm-hmm. set up account for individuals. So it's pretty interesting. I mean, once you get in, you know, we both experienced in Las Vegas one night with another hunter, Corbin, that once you get a little bit inside, it's pretty insane where you can get to, yeah, privilege escalation wise. So that's like where we're at now. So we found an account that we took over the email and we saw he had permissions to some other applications that we knew based on the subdomains that there was an application with login page there with Azure. So we wanted to try to take over that account and log into an internal application. So that's what we did. We managed to log in. It didn't ask us for any 2FA. And now we got into an internal CRM application. It looked like it was built in the 70s. There was nothing in the 70s, but it's still like it looks something like that.
Yeah.
Like, you know the feeling when you log in something. And yeah, it was wild.
Shag carpet everywhere, shag carpet and peace signs if it's from the 70s.
You know the feeling when you see like something that you say, okay, I can see the bugs already, so you're mentally prepared to like, okay, yeah, it's time to walk. No more bullshit around, no more taking the time. So straight away, looking around like 10 to 15 minutes, LFIs everywhere, RCEs everywhere, SSRF everywhere, must be ILEAK everywhere. Admin SRF to Azure metadata, admin access, all the secrets access, access to everything, which is, it's not a normal bug bounty story or bug, because usually you stop at the secret. No. Like, you would usually stop at the bearer token of them, and like, hey company, I don't want to play with you anymore. You validate the critical impact. And I mean, it's the same critical, right? Usually in terms of bug bounty. This engagement, they wanted us to do like, hey, show us the full impact and we'll compensate you also if you find better impact than the normal impact of the bug bounty. But yeah, it's like, it's not that usual, but it's pretty interesting chain. It's like starting from the outside with no leads to like resources that are not related to the company. And then so many anomalies the companies could see if they had like track, like there's so many points we could have got caught, you know, because it took 2 weeks, what you see here. It took 2 to 3 weeks and it sounds like it took 5 minutes, but and it takes a lot of time to them. But once you pre-vest and get to the internal application, it's like the GG happens very fast, you know? Like
I think this is a really good example of like how you get pwned in a cloud environment. You know, like leaking that bearer on the outside, I think is one of those very, very bad mistakes where you can, you know, then turn it from an external to an internal. And once you're already in the internal, it's game over in a lot of ways. It's just a matter of time before you get to the secrets of everything. So, wow, dude, this is a very impressive one. I can see why you chose this one. This one's great. So thanks for sharing it, man. Appreciate that.
Okay. Wow, that was cool, man.
Dude,
I hadn't heard that bug before from Nagli, so that's it's always good. He's always got some crazy stuff cooking.
Dude, the recon game on that bug was nuts, right? Where he is actually identifying this leak by looking at what assets are client side redirecting to an InScope asset. That is nuts. That's so much to sift through to find this.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah,
it's really cool.
And then I think the other cool thing about this one is just that you have such flexibility, right, with this program. They're letting you sort of pivot internally so much. You mostly only get opportunities like this during pen tests typically. And this time they just kind of let them have at it. So props to the team on that one. That one's a really cool bug that we probably wouldn't have been able to hear about if they weren't so permissive with their bug bounty program. So.
Yeah, super cool.
All right, let's cut to the next one. Shubs is up next, so we're going to hear about some crazy shit for sure. I'm excited.
Yeah, so essentially, if you guys know my MO and my style, I mostly focus on pre-authentication vulnerabilities that lead to critical server-side impact. In this case, this was for a live hacking event for HackerOne, and it was a specific vendor product which has been looked at quite heavily, not just by my team at AssetNote, but pretty much hundreds of hackers over the years. And and really, this vendor software has a Linux component or a Windows component you can install on a server. It is a really big piece of software. It has you know, gigabytes of JAR files and things like that. But anyways, in all the different times that I've looked at this software over the years, never been able to find something that's pre-authentication and lead to some sort of critical impact. But this one was particularly interesting. It was something that required like maybe six or seven different steps in the exploit chain to get to command execution.
Oh my God, dude.
When we start off, you know, like we look at the process explorer, we look at Procmon, we see what processes are running in this vendor application and what different technologies are there. And, you know, it's a wide variety of things in this one. There's, you know, Apache HTTP server, there's a lot of Java processes, and then there's, you know, also one really peculiar Node.js process, which we can get into a little bit more. Now, a lot of people, when they ship Node.js server-side code for these vendor applications, they compile it to V8 bytecode. When it is V8 bytecode, it is a pain in the ass to look at. You load it into Ghidra and you're like, what am I looking at? I don't understand. And there has been some developments over time where some people have, you know, made it a little bit easier to look at, but it's still a total pain in the ass. And I don't think that, I think that the main reason why people hadn't found stuff in this Node.js component is purely because they had compiled the Node.js server-side code to V8 bytecode and no one spent the time to understand what was going on there. And I don't blame them either. We had also skipped this several times because we were like, we don't have the time to spend on this. The first real breakthrough came when Kim and I realized that this entire component was accessible via the HTTPD config in a way that was pre-authentication. And it was responding in a way which was basically saying like, the URL is missing. Now that's obviously, as you know, Justin, if you see something that says that the URL is missing, jump at that opportunity.
That is a big indicator. The heart starts beating fast as soon as you see that.
Yeah, exactly. And you see something like that and you're like, okay, I really need to dig into this more. And what I found was it was a part of some SDK that this organization had made to create these special add-ons for the software. And, you know, I just took a little bit of a stab in the dark and I found some SDK documentation and a package on NPM. I downloaded that package and I found that actually all of the server-side source code for that component was within that package, which is amazing. No. I mean, that made it so much easier. Now, I will caveat that with the fact that the server-side source code was still in many ways obfuscated and minified. So it was still somewhat tricky to understand, but trust me, I'll take reading JavaScript over reading V8 bytecode.
V8 bytecode, man, yeah, I'm sure.
Absolutely, yeah. I will take that any day of the week. So I started digging into this and I started realizing that, wow, this is actually a really complex component of this application such that it has this whole ecosystem that it provides of this SDK and applications. There were several headers that you could provide for this endpoint that would essentially load a file from the disk and load it into this application SDK sandbox environment.
Dude, now, you must have been so hyped when you saw this scope, dude, when it was starting doing this stuff. You're like, finally, something interesting pre-auth.
100%. Yeah. And that was really interesting because, you know, the target we were looking at for the event was a Linux system. But really, the reason why this entire attack vector can be done pre-authentication on Windows specifically is because of the fact that Windows allows you to provide two backslashes and a system volume, and then suddenly that's going to reach out to connect via network share and pull data from there. But essentially, there was a header that loaded a file, and on Windows, obviously, you can use the network share. On Linux, you actually have to have it to be a local file. So yeah, it was really interesting. So I was loading this, and this file format, for all intents and purposes, was just a glorified zip file. And inside the zip file was some JavaScript files and a manifest file, which basically dictated what this plugin would do.
And was this supposed to be, do you know if this API was supposed to be used internally by the application or whether this was something that the client would actually hit at some point?
Well, that's the really surprising part. I actually couldn't find any legitimate use for this in any way or form. I don't know if this was rogue developer's side project that somehow got shipped to production, or there was really obscure feature somewhere. But to be honest, everywhere in the application, there was zero references to this. There was no real understanding of why this would be used legitimately. It was some dormant feature that had been there for quite some time, but really didn't seem like it was actively used by the community in any way or form. So definitely a little bit of dead code there, I think. That zip file, it had a manifest file, it had some other JavaScript files, and it started getting me thinking, like, what's going on with this? How is this executing? And it turns out that it was being executed within a isolated VM sandbox, which is, you know, not the worst thing. It's a good sign that your server-side code is being executed. Good starting point. But I also know from my experience that isolated VM, when it's updated to the newest version, is actually quite tricky to bypass and escape. I'm pretty sure that isolated VM sandbox bypass escapes would be quite valuable in any sense. So really what I started looking at was, the first thing I looked at was the ability to get SSRF, because this environment was on AWS and we could, you know, potentially we could read the metadata IP, the security credentials, get access that way. So started crafting that. And what I found was the first roadblock was I needed to somehow smuggle a zip file onto the local system and know the exact path of where that zip file was. This was a lot trickier than I thought it would be, but that was one of the first stages, was getting that zip file there.
Once especially I was able to pre-auth, right? Like that's a big condition, but especially if you're trying to maintain the pre-authness of this bug, that's a big precondition.
100%. Yeah. So on Windows, the good thing is that we can just host it on a network share, but on Linux, we actually had to do this in a post-auth mechanism. So we actually had to authenticate and then upload the zip file in a post-auth way. But on Windows, you can just do a network share and forget about all this stuff, and you can just point it to your SMB and then get it to pull it from there. But on this target for this event we were looking at, we were able to get a file in a known location that we were able to load through this API endpoint. And we were able to achieve SSRF out of the box quite easily. But really, we wanted RCE, right? So that's what we always aim for. So what we found was this isolated VM sandbox, there was actually a number of default modules that was made available to it. One of them was to load Parquet files. And I had never been familiar with Parquet files. And really, I started digging into this more, but this is when I tapped on Riotac's shoulder. Now, I have never worked with Riotac before, but I only have some of the best things to say about him. I was very, very impressed working with him, and we had a lot of fun exploiting this together. I know you've also had many experiences working with him, so you would understand.
Dude, he's something else, man. He really is. Unbelievable. Yeah.
Unbelievable. And neither of us had worked with Parquet files or DuckDB or any of these different components, but we were slowly getting there. So what we found was it would load a Parquet file, and within the Parquet file, we would be able to basically cause a SQL injection when it loads it into DuckDB. So they were using DuckDB and they were loading a Parquet file, and within that process, there was a SQL injection, which we could SQL inject into DuckDB. Now, DuckDB is a relatively newish database technology that's being used a bit more commonly, is really interesting, because DuckDB has a lot of functionalities which I think are inherently quite insecure. The fact like you can create files, you can do all sorts of things through DuckDB that's, you know, quite sensitive. Now, the only reason why all of this worked was because these modules were being basically inherited within the isolated VM sandbox. So we were using server-side code that was already inherited in the isolated VM sandbox that could let us escape the sandbox, essentially.
Ah, interesting.
So this is how it worked. But we still had a few more roadblocks. So we basically construct a zip that has Parquet file, that loads Parquet file from a URL, that then leads to the SQL injection, that then leads to DuckDB doing something naughty. But what actually happened was we weren't able to get DuckDB to execute that injected SQL when we loaded into DuckDB. Now, that was probably because we weren't actually triggering that portion of SQL that we had injected. So what we had to do then is we had to leverage the first SSRF we had in this chain to communicate to a different port on the server, which was responsible for managing DuckDB, and then trigger a refresh or a load of that table inside DuckDB, which would then lead to the file write.
Oh my gosh. It's almost like a delayed SQL injection there.
That's right. We do need that second step to get that SQL injection to trigger.
Oh my gosh.
So we were able to get there, but the problem was, where do we write to? Now, this was a modern Java application. And a lot of modern Java applications, they don't actually have JSP handlers. They basically, like if you look at any modern Spring Java application, they don't actually need to have the ability to process and render JSP files. So this modern Java application, we go through these several different web apps inside the Tomcat directory, and we really struggle to find a location to write this JSP shell. which we thought was the most logical way to exploit this.
Which but, you got from the arbitrary write on DuckDB.
That's right.
Gotcha.
Yeah, that's okay. Right. So at this point, we've got an arbitrary file write through many, many different stages of exploitation, but we don't know where to write the file to get the command execution. So that's kind of where we were stuck on for a little bit. And what we found was in Tomcat, in web XML files, sometimes there is a specific handler for exceptions. And this was one of the only locations that we found where we could exploit this. There was this, for one of the web applications, there was a handler for 500 errors for exceptions that was pointing to a JSP file inside one of the tag library folders. So what we did was we replaced that JSP file that was a handler for 500 exceptions, and we replaced that with our shell. And then we basically exploited this by triggering a 500 error in the application that then triggered our arbitrary code from that whole process. So at the end, we had command execution, but that was the chain. So I don't know if you have any questions or any comments on this chain.
Yeah. So it's crazy that at the end it's like, okay, now I need to trigger a 500 error. Like now I've got to find some unhandled exception that just screws this whole system up. That's crazy. Okay. So I'm trying to follow with all of this. Just, I'm going to try to recap it a little bit here, and you catch me where I get it wrong. Okay. So we find this compiled Node.js binary that is mapped to a specific route. You hit that, you can hit it unauthenticated. You can upload a zip file. That zip file will run JS code in an isolated VM. And then from there, we need to have the code inside of that run something that triggers the SQL injection. So that's the part where you lost me.
Yeah. So basically, there are a lot of default functions within this SDK. One of those functions is to load a Parquet file. When it loads the Parquet file from a URL, it will then load it into DuckDB.
And that's where you got the SSRF. Okay, so it loads the Parquet file from the... And that's
that's where I got the SQL injection. So the SSRF is separate as well. It's such a complex bug. Yeah, it's such a complex bug. No, I apologize. So basically, you've got a endpoint that loads a zip file that then runs inside an isolated VM. You can achieve SSRF quite easily, but we want to escape the isolated VM to get command execution. Right. So the way we do that is, let's just say we already have our SSRF ready on one side, ready to go.
Sure.
Now we load a second zip file, which loads the Parquet that loads the DuckDB SQL injection. Then we use that first SSRF to trigger that SQL injection through a different port that then refreshes that DuckDB table. And that lets us write anywhere on the system. And then when we want to write on the system, we got to find a place. And since it's a modern Java application, the only location we could find was a exception handler within the web XML. And rewriting that 500.jsp, which was to handle 500 exceptions, and then triggering a 500 exception would lead to the RCE.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to try to recap it here. I think I got this. So we find the route, the unauthenticated route. We upload to there. Then there's some sort of SDK where you can trigger the parsing of a Parquet file. Is that right?
Yeah.
And then that you get the SQL injection from there, but it's delayed. It needs to be triggered. So you use the SSRF to trigger that SQL injection. That gets your arbitrary file right. And then you write into the JSP file. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, it's definitely one of my favorite bugs by far. And you know, it's pretty crazy.
How did you end up triggering the 500?
Without
giving too much information away on the target.
No, we caused a null pointer exception within the application to trigger the 500. Yeah. It was also funny because the application was load bound, so you had to hit it 5 or 10 times before you got the shell to show up.
Of course, for the heck of it there, just add that extra variable to it. Wow, dude. That is a crazy bug and a masterpiece. So thank you for sharing that with us, man.
No problem. And yeah, just want to give a shout out to Ryotech as well, who worked on this with me. Very, very enjoyable process. And I think he'll remember this one fondly as well for the years to come.
Dude, these typical subs.
Dude, I'm literally just sitting here still after listening to that again and just being like, Wow, what an absolute masterpiece, man. The time delayed, you know, SQL injection. What is that, man?
It's so crazy. It's so crazy.
That's nuts, dude. Wow. Well, definitely shout out to Shubs on that one. That was amazing. And of course, AudioTuck as well. Great work, gentlemen. Great work. All right. Next one up is Matt Brown. Let's go see what he's got.
So NTP is a bug, and NTP issues are a bug class that some people find impactful, some people don't, but they're, right. I find them interesting because I like to go back to my roots of looking at data as it goes across the wire. Mm. So this bug that I found was on an IoT device that had parental controls, right? So mm-hmm. a parent could hand this device to their child and they could browse, you know, a limited set of media, and they could do that in a safe way. Mm. And the mm. other thing parents could do, there was this feature where they could set a bedtime. and so during a certain time, as a parent, you know, I'm drawn to these kind of features, right?
Right.
And so there was a feature in this device where you could set a bedtime where all of the media would be disabled during the bedtime. And so any time where an application is telling you no because of what time it is, Douglas Day has this great talk where he talks about looking for the no's in an application.
What a legendary talk, dude. That yeah. talk was so good.
It's so simple and yet so profound. And so what I guess I'm introducing here is one of the ways that an application can tell you no is by what time it is. Mm. Is by mm. when is when is a way that an application can tell you no. And so if that is occurring, especially in a mobile app or an IoT device, then you have to ask, where is it getting that time data from?
Right.
So NTP is the most common protocol you see to acquire time data. And so it's one of two protocols actually in 2024 that by and large is still flying around the internet, unencrypted, unauthenticated, right?
Love that and for us.
Yeah, yeah, it's great. And the other one, it's interesting. It's actually an interesting use case. The other one is DNS. Mm. But DNS, we just assume that it's not trusted. And then we do things like certificate verification, to build trust on top of something that's not trustworthy, right? Mm. And so on this device, I was able to spoof NTP. I was able to spoof what time it is. And to do this, I use a tool called DeLorean. And so, you know, aptly named, right?
Solid. I can see where they got it. Yeah.
if you're doing some time travel, you got to use DeLorean.
Right,
and so
right.
All it is it's just a spoofed, you know, NTP server that you can intercept the NTP traffic with and provide whatever time you want. And so on this IoT device, we were able to bypass the bedtime for the child by spoofing that it was like the middle of the day when the bedtime was set for nighttime, right?
Right.
And then you're able to bypass those parental controls in that way.
Very
and
cool,
so,
man.
If you're not a parent, you might not think that that's like a cool threat model, but I've found similar threats in things like smart locks, where a smart lock will have a feature where you can have a PIN that you set for your cleaning person, right? Mm, mm. And so that PIN will only let them in at a certain time or a certain day. And so in that situation, it's the same exact bug, but the threat model is interesting because those people you're letting into your home, they might actually have access to your Wi-Fi network. And so the attack becomes a lot more realistic.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, actually.
In that threat model where they're allowed access to your home, but only at a certain time. Mm-hmm. And so they have access to things that would allow them to perform this man-in-the-middle attack and then be able to trick the lock or whatever thing it is into thinking it's a different time.
Dang, dude. That is a pretty unique attack vector.
Hell yeah. I mean, it's so cool. I love that Douglas's talk always keeps coming up in all these different people's things, whether it's at NahomCon or at this, or I mean, we talked to Douglas directly about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, finding those no's, it's very, very consistent.
Yeah, and it's so applicable across so many different scopes, right? You know, you can apply it to pretty much anything. Such a simple concept. It's just those really nice little simple concepts that really just resound with you, I think.
Yeah, totally.
Solid. All right. Well, up next is somebody who's been on the pod a lot lately. I've been squeezing this guy for some content, man. Really, like he's just got so much good stuff. So let's go see what Matan Bear has for us as for a bug for this year.
So this one was in a very big site that I won't name, because the bug is gonna come out soon because that site I think is gonna disclose it, but I'm still exploiting bypasses and stuff. So this was a very complicated bug in the way that site rendered Markdown. So there was some sort of scenario where an attacker could make the site render malicious Markdown in sort of the victim's browser or the victim's context.
Okay.
And that scenario, the way they rendered the Markdown, was pretty complicated because they wanted to allow the Markdown to load images and stuff like that from specific sources that otherwise it wouldn't have access to. Sorry for having it be a little it's vague, but yeah, I'm trying to work around the actual mentions of what the target is.
I appreciate you agreeing to disclose it, even though you're still actively milking it. For those as well listening, we have some graphics up on YouTube as well. If this complicated explanation doesn't make sense just over audio.
Honestly, it was so complicated. I made the graphics for myself so I could keep track of things.
That's great.
It definitely took me a while to figure that one out. So the sort of the way they rendered the Markdown, they had like the top window, like the top frame, and that frame didn't do a lot of stuff. The actual frame that had most of the context, most of the content was just an iframe inside that window that was like full screen. And I called that frame the main frame. Okay. Then inside that frame, there was sort of a bridge frame that had like a different origin. So if the main frame was like redactor.com, this was like some weird subdomain.redactor.com, right? And then inside that bridge frame, there was a sandbox frame with that same like weird subdomain.redactor.com origin. Okay.
So we've got top frame. That's on redacted.com.
Yeah.
Main frame inside of that, which is on redacted.com. Then we've got the bridge frame on some weird origin. And then inside of that, we've got the sandbox frame also on some weird origin.
Yeah, we're four layers deep.
Four layers deep. Let's go.
So the role of like the bridge frame was to sort of bridge the communication between the sandbox frame and the main frame.
Okay.
And the sandbox frame is just where the malicious HTML is rendered. Okay, so because malicious HTML is rendered in the sandbox frame, it's very trivial to, or at least it was very trivial to get XSS on it. Okay, you can just run JavaScript in there. Now,
and it was allow scripts was enabled on the sandbox.
Yeah, you could just run JS, like very simple. They just thought that it wouldn't have impact, but and like in and of itself, the XSS in that subdomain actually didn't have a lot of impact. But there was a feature that I mentioned that allowed the Markdown inside the sandbox frame to load assets, say like images, from like the actual site. So from like redactor.com. So if there's an image that only the victim can access, the Markdown can load it. Okay. So now there's already an impact that you can see. Like if the Markdown can render that image, so you have an attack scenario where if you know like the path to the image, you can render it, and then from the JavaScript execution that you have, you can get the content of the image. But I wasn't very satisfied with that because that's a pretty lame attack scenario. So I looked into how the actual loading of the image works. And that's very interesting. So the way it worked, and sorry for the graphic being a little complicated.
Gosh.
But the sandbox frame sends an HTTP request, right? To load the image or something like that.
Okay.
And that request gets intercepted by a service worker that lives on that frame, okay? That service worker then sends a message to the bridge frame, letting it know that the sandbox frame just tried to load an image or something like that from this specific path, okay? Then the bridge frame forwards that message to the mainframe, okay? And then the mainframe does some validation on the URL that it tried to load. So if that URL is like under, I don't know, redacted.com/images, okay? There was like a bunch of specific paths that it could have been under. Then it would actually send the request and then forward the response back to the bridge frame. And now all of the forwarding happens in reverse. So the bridge frame forwards the response back to the service worker, which forwards it back to the sandbox frame. So wow. You've got like request being sent from the sandbox frame to the service worker, to the bridge, to the mainframe, then some validation, then a response is sent back to the bridge frame and then to the service worker and then to the sandbox frame.
Okay. Okay. So we've created almost a proxy at this point, right? From the sandbox frame origin back up through the mainframe with some validation and then back down to the sandbox frame.
Exactly.
Okay.
So of course I tried messing a little with the validation, but the problem was that if I tried to do, and this is a bit of a spoiler, but a path traversal, I can't really do that with this setup, because if I send a request that has like a path traversal in its URL, it's gonna get normalized by the browser before it even reaches the service worker.
Right. On the original request that was sent before it hits the service worker. Okay.
So what I did here, because the sandbox frame and the bridge frame are same origin, I could just from the sandbox frame hop here and start executing JS here. Okay.
Oh my gosh, now, dude. What?
This is the most funny part of the whole bug. Maybe they thought of that. Maybe it was for some other reason. But in the sandbox frame, they overridden window.parent to be null. So you couldn't do like parent.eval or something like
okay,
that.
Okay, sure.
But I just went like top.frames.whatever.
Sure, and you can just traverse down from the top. Okay.
Or if that if top was also overridden, I probably could have...
there's a million like ways
open,
to get
access
to it, sure.
Open and then parent or a million ways. So that's like not actual isolation. Once I had a JS execution in the bridge frame, I tried to find some way that I can hijack this communication. So the way this communication
meaning the communication between the bridge frame and the mainframe.
I forget that not everyone is watching on YouTube. The communication between the bridge frame and the mainframe. The way it worked is that the mainframe sent a message port to the bridge frame and they communicated via that message port. Okay. So both had like access to some message port that they sent messages through. So what I did once I had JS execution in the bridge frame, I overrode the prototype of message port, okay?
Oh my God.
So the function that is responsible for sending messages through message ports is messageport.prototype.postmessage. And when you have some port, say like P1, and you do P1.postmessage, the function that actually gets called is that prototype function. So if I override it, then I can, when such a call is made, p1.postmessage, my malicious function is gonna get called. And if you're familiar with JavaScript, the value of this variable when my function gets called is gonna be p1.
Right. So, long story short, the message port.
Yeah. Long story short, by overriding some function in JavaScript, I could get access to the message port that is used for this communication, meaning the communication between the bridge and the mainframe. Whenever the bridge frame sends a message. So I could just override that prototype, trigger some action that makes it send a message. In this case, like calling fetch from the sandbox frame because that whole communication is gonna forward it.
Right.
So now I had access to the message port, okay? And I could send like raw communication to the mainframe. I didn't have to go through the browser's parsing of URLs. So what I try to do now is path traversal, okay? Because I mentioned that there were like a bunch of root paths that were allowed in the validation that the mainframe does on the URL. Quite surprisingly, actually, they checked whether the paths had dot dot slash sequences, okay?
Wow, okay.
Yeah. Which it's that's impressive because it isn't often that people actually think of that, especially when there's this sort of complex communication.
Right.
But they didn't consider backslashes.
Yeah, I knew it, dude. I knew it. As soon as you said that, I was like, but they didn't get the backslash, did they?
So many pitfalls in that. Yeah.
Oh my God.
So I could send like a request to redactor.com slash. And by request, I mean like a message that represents a request to redacted.com slash images or whatever whitelisted root path, and then dot dot backslash and a bunch of backslashes. And then I could just send requests as the victim, like make the mainframe send requests to whatever path under redacted.com. Okay. Mm. Wow. And that just led to account takeover.
And then at that point, I mean, do you have like control of like the object that gets passed into like the request initiator object or something like that? So you can specify like post, you know, mode is post or whatever, and include credentials.
Yeah,
and that sort of thing?
I had a ton of control.
Wow, dude.
Like, that is a good question because it isn't completely expected. If you're strictly looking at the case of images, but I think that because with images, you're only gonna need like get requests with nobody.
Right.
But I think they tried to make this setup a little more generic. I'm not sure for which use case, but yeah, that just was in there.
Wow. So then you were able to send a message from the bridge frame to the mainframe that would just trigger account takeover on the application?
So I sent a request that was like a GET request to some endpoint. Then I got the CSRF token back from that because I can read the responses.
Right.
Then I sent another one, a post that did some change on the account and with the correct CSRF token, and that was just a account takeover.
Oh my God, Matan, dude, that's crazy. I love the trick, the prototype pollution trick, right? Where you override the prototype, because that getting a reference to that message port would have been a massive pain in the ass, you know. But you can just override the prototype, snag it right as it's going through, and then now you've got access to that one side of the can, right? That we always talk about when we talk about message ports.
Yeah, I like that you started using my analogy.
It's great, dude. It's a great analogy for that, for sure.
So that trick of like when you get JS execution in some context and you want to get access to some secret or something like that, overriding prototypes is actually more generic than you might expect. I had one case on a completely different target where I could like... let me give a theoretical example that would be more interesting.
Sure.
Say you have like self-XSS on some site. I know that I talk about self-XSS too much.
Dude,
but
that's like your shit, but whatever. it's like
I don't want to be known as this self-XSS guy. That
well,
like,
hey, man, the guy that turned self-XSS into real XSS is pretty good.
Yeah. Every self-XSS that I touch turns into gold.
Yeah.
From shit into gold.
You're going to get a shit ton of DMs now being like, I've got self-XSS when I paste this thing into this thing.
That was a mistake, yeah.
Yeah.
So say you have a self-XSS on some site.
Okay.
Right? And you can't use the trick that we talked about in our pod episode to convert that self-XSS into a regular XSS.
Sure.
So the conventional way of exploiting that would be you have some page and then you open, you like from the attacker site, open a page to target.com, right? When the victim is still logged into their account, then you make them log into your account, trigger the self-XSS, and then execute JavaScript in the page that you opened originally.
Right.
Right. So what's interesting is if that site, target.com, uses like access tokens instead of cookies for authentication to the API, okay? If they store those access tokens like in memory, in their fetch implementation, in some variable, what you can do is actually after you make them log into your account and start executing JavaScript in the target.com page, okay, like the original one that has the victim's account, the access token to the victim's account is still gonna be in memory. And when you trigger some action that triggers communication with the API, the fetch is still gonna contain the access token. Right.
Wow. Yeah.
So what you can do is override the fetch function, trigger that action
on the opener window. So do
on the window that has
the victim session or whatever,
authenticated window. Let's call it. Yeah.
Wow.
The auth window. You can override the fetch function, trigger an action that makes the page communicate with the API, and then catch that that token from memory.
Wow, dude, that's crazy. And as long as it doesn't reload it from local storage or whatever, or then you're good. Or maybe they have it in session storage, and even if it does,
right, you can something that won't get updated when you make them log out from their account.
Wow, dude, you're like the self-XSS master, man. There's so many different self-XSS techniques you drop on this pod, man. Dude, all that client-side stuff just, it makes me so excited. I can see that you understood all of that, right, Joel?
That made my brain hurt. That made my brain hurt.
I know you love it, man.
I'm looking at the diagram of this, and it still makes my brain hurt.
It's crazy, dude. He's really something else, that guy.
It's crazy. Cool. All right. Well, now we've got one from our boy, speaking of, Douglas Day.
Douglas Day.
Speaking of the nose and all that, we've got one from the man himself. So let's listen.
Yeah. So the bug I'm most proud of for 2024 happened a while back. I was hacking on a company and they had a pretty wide scope, and they had a subdomain which was exclusively used to advertise and broadcast events that were happening within that company's product. And so on that subdomain, I see a little calendar at the bottom, and it's like talking about future events that they're going to be streaming or broadcasting. And I'm like, and I had this itch go off on my head. I'm like, oh, how cool would it be if I were able to make my own events and put them on their calendar? You know, I like, not many people come to my birthday party. I'm like, what if I got this entire company's like user base to show up at my birthday party? Like, you know, I'd be like so many presents. I'd get a lot of like happy birthdays. It'd be awesome. So I'm like, okay, I want to make my birthday be a public event for this company. All right, so how do I do that? So I pull up Kaido and I'm looking at the request history, and I see that when that calendar loads, it makes a request to a third party, or in this case, a third party, really, that is a online streaming service that companies can use to like host their their broadcasts. I'm like, okay, this actually sounds pretty interesting. So I do some Googling on this third party, and I see that it has a free self sign up. I'm like, okay, what if I can get like, what if I can make my own organization and then find some IDOR? And so I created my own account on the streaming service with my own website that had, you know, just garbage data. And I found the spot to make like events and videos, and I made my own and it did use a UUID. And so I was initially a bit discouraged. I'm like, oh, this is an unguessable ID. But because the victims or my target's subdomain was public, like when it pulls those events, it's pulling it with the UUID. So I have it. It's public information. So I go and I try the UUID, and sure enough, there's an IDOR there. I can like modify videos and events. So I'm like, okay, this is cool.
Oh my gosh.
This is pretty like untouched. Like this is pretty exclusive scope. Let's go further. And so I start testing every piece of functionality. I'm like, okay, there's an IDOR there. There's an IDOR here. There's an IDOR there. Oh, there's an XSS.
You hit the golden goose, dude.
Yeah, I did. Cause I'm the only one hacking on this particular app, right? Cause it's a third party. I don't even think I had asked the customer yet if it was going to be
shot here, right? Like, I hope this is going to be in scope. I hope they're going to pay for
this. And that's kind of how you got to do it, right? Like when hacking on Bug Bounty, like the skill is not finding bugs. Like you can learn how to find bugs. Mm-hmm. The skill, like the real skill is finding scope. Mm. And so I'm like, okay, this is a scope that no one else has touched. If I can get this to be paid, then this is going to, you know, I'm going to be sitting real happy. So anywho, I'm like, okay, I've got an IDOR everywhere. I've got XSS that I can IDOR. So I can like, it's a self XSS, but I can like turn it into, I can chain it with an IDOR to basically deliver an XSS onto my target's website. What else can I do? And I'm like, okay, what if I can just like go for the, you know, shoot for the stars and get an ATO? Mm. So I'm like, okay, there's of course the functionality to invite other like users or admins to your organization. So my first idea is, okay, what if I can like invite an existing user into my org? You know, can you exist in more than one org? It turns out you can't, but when you add someone to your organization, there's two ways to do it. You can either send them an email, and of course I'm not going to have access to the email, so I can't use that, or you can give them a link and to click on and then go through the auth flow there. So I'm like, okay, so I invite but the link is tied to that user's email address. And so I find out who the admin is on my target's organization. I add them as an admin to my organization, but because I don't have access to their email, I just copy the link, go into an incognito window, go through the auth flow, accept the invite. Now that user is now simultaneously both in their organization and my organization.
What?
But because they're in my organization, I can change their email address. And so I change their email address to an email that I control. And then I go through the password reset flow to reset their password and then be able to log into the victim's organization.
So at that point, it was an arbitrary ATO. This wasn't like, yep. I thought you were going to chain like the IDOR with XSS into like an ATO, but it still required them to like at least log into the app. But this one is just arbitrary ATO.
Yeah, as long as you have their email. I did have to play a bit of a game where I was like having to like scroll through social media and like message people on LinkedIn. Like, oh, what? If I found an issue with this particular website, can you let me know what they're, well, like that services admin's email it is? But sure. I couldn't find it. So I eventually had to get the bug bounty team to tell me who their admin for this particular site was. Mm. But yeah, it was a zero click ATO, all I needed was their email address. Then I could invite them to my org and then change their email address and then change their password. And then I got access to their org, and that opened up even more scope, because then I could look for like privilege escalations. I could look for features that weren't like enabled and enable those. I could like change billing information. It was a very impactful bug. I think including the bonus.
Did they pay for all of those, or did they dupe them all back, or how did it work?
They duped each. So I, being a bug bounty hunter, of course, try to maximize my profit, right? And so I filed every like endpoint as a different report,
right?
As well as each HTTP verb. And so, of course, you know, I would like, if I could modify on, you know, slash events, I would file that as a bug. If I could delete events, I'd file that as a bug. If I could retrieve private events, I'd file that as a bug. And they did keep the different endpoints separate, but then they lumped the different all the verbs together.
I feel like that's a good option, right? Because it's like you submit all of those and then they sort of meet you in the middle, right? Whereas if you had just submitted each individual endpoint, then they might have been like, okay, well, we're just going to dupe it down to two reports. But now you got...
Exactly.
I think it's good. I think it's a good strategy. Dude, classic green hat move from our boy Douglas there, huh?
It's like, you know me, I'm going to maximize my profit.
Every single HTTP verb and every single endpoint. It's great. I mean, hey, that's the way you maximize profit.
You're not a full-time bug bounty hunter if you haven't done that. That's what I've come to realize. That's the big difference.
Yeah. It's interesting, too, that he spent a lot of time, you know, going down that rabbit hole of, even though it was a third-party app, you know, I think... In this scenario, I think he probably trusted the program that they would pay based off of impact, but that's a pretty scary thing to do, I think.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. But another cool bug, of course.
Indeed. All right, let's hop next over to AJ Chapman.
Oh man, so this was just one of those really frustrating bugs that I came across. So I was kind of in between programs looking for something new to hack on. And I saw a program that I've been wanting to hack on for a while, but they had Codalo Bounty Table. Mm. So I hadn't looked them up to that point. But then I noticed they had a three times multiplier on critical reports for 10 days. So brilliant. This gives me the opportunity to actually spend time there. Obviously, I kind of noticed this with 2 days left of the promotion to go. But screw it. I can find a critical in 2 days. So kind of bring it up and obviously... What bugs do I look for? I exploit server-side Chrome. That's pretty much all I do anymore. So the first thing I do, I see this kind of fancy dashboard system, and you can export the dashboard as a PDF. It's definitely using a server-side browser to do that. So kind of set up a dashboard, export that, and check the PDF metadata. And that's where you can tell if it's using kind of Chrome or dedicated HTML to PDF or something like that. So if you check the creator or producer PDF metadata options, that will tell you what it's using and normally the precise version it's using, which is great. So in this case, it was using Chrome 119, which was perfect. I had an exploit in the bag already for Chrome 119 and thought, great, good to go. So let's see what I can do. The only problem is this was not meant to execute kind of user-provided JavaScript. Mm. So I was going to try and find the cross-site scripting. I've said it before and I will say it again, I'm the worst web app tester. I hate it. I've got no interest in it whatsoever.
But you really need those XSSs for your vulns. So.
Yeah, tell me about it. So I kind of sat down and thought, like, normally I would give up, but there was this three times crypt promotion on this, and I thought, you know what, I'm going to get this. I'm going to exploit this one. So sat down there with the kind of started looking through the minified JavaScript and realized I'm not going to get anywhere with that. So threw it into Claude, see what it could come up with, and kind of noticed you could add rich text elements to these dashboards. So you could add descriptions of your graphs and all the rest of it, including rich text. So that's normally a pretty good place for injecting HTML. Mm-hmm. So kind of have a look at that. And obviously it's protected using DOM Purify. Great. Okay. What version? Latest version DOM Purify. Game over. All right. Yeah. Fine. Look around. Then I did that thing that all kind of newbie hackers do, as I went to a GitHub gist full of XSS payloads and thought, here we go, throw that at it. See if anything sticks. Obviously nothing happened. Mm-hmm. Kind of start keyboard mashing a little bit, just throwing in anything I could, and noticed that if you added text URLs, they got linkified, so they became clickable links. I was like, well, I didn't add an A tag, I didn't add the required HTML to do that, so kind of delved into that a little bit more and found they were actually editing the input HTML after it had been through the DOM Purify stage.
Ooh, nice.
Now, I don't know a huge amount about XSS, but I know that's bad. editing synthesized JavaScript is a bad thing. So what they were doing, they were taking anywhere, so then throw your input through DOM purify, and then anywhere it found a regex for URL, it would replace that with the a tag, href equals your URL, and then the URL in the text portion of the a tag. So kind of brought up the various payloads on XSS payloads to kind of look at this, and I came across this one. The other thing is, obviously, it being a server-side browser, sorry, jumping back a bit, I couldn't use an on-click event or anything like that. Had to happen automatically as soon as the page was loaded.
Right, right.
So I think using the Portswigger XSS cheat sheet, it came across this details tag with the open element, open attribute. And if that exists, the on-toggle event handler for that element will fire. So, okay, kind of starting to piece it all together now. So came up with this input tag, which was details with the open attribute and then an arbitrary attribute name. In this case, it was called X with a crafted link in it, which went through DOM purify, give or take unmodified. And then when it was applied to the linkifier script, it then was able to escape out of the arbitrary attribute I gave it into an on-toggle attribute for the details element and kind of trigger the event. And the
dude, you say you're not a web hacker. That's a pretty leet flow, dude. That's freaking sick.
That took me a long time. I hate to admit it. But I was pretty chuffed with myself on this.
But you made it. You made it inside of the critical deadline, yeah?
Yeah. So this, I think, had about 8 hours to go at this point. So I've got my XSS. I've got my pre-written exploit in the bag, kind of link it all up, XSS payload to inject an iframe, export the PDF, and nothing happened.
No, no.
Seriously, I'm sitting there waiting for this shell back, although these shell commands back, and nothing happened. Literally got 8 hours to get this report in to be in the campaign deadline, and I just stopped panic debugging. Like, what is going on? And I must have thrown probably 200 PDF requests at the app from this point, just trying to work out what was going on. And then eventually realized that in the back end, the web browser disabled WebAssembly, and the exploit I was using, CVE 2024 2887, is a WebAssembly bug.
Oh, shit. Okay.
So I'm trying to throw this thing at it, and it just wasn't going to work. So, all right, okay, kind of give up in a bit of a huff. I'm like, no, come on, we can do this,
Let's go, let's go, come on.
So I found I believe it was a Taiwanese blog detailing another Chrome exploit for that version, and like throwing it through Google Translate, trying to find as much information as I could, kind of, I think it was getting late at night at this point as well, so a couple of coffees in. It's like panic writing this exploit, trying to get it to work. And it worked locally. I'm like, yes, brilliant, this is good. Throw it up, doesn't work. Okay.
No, not refresh. Again.
Doesn't work. God. Refresh, doesn't work. Like the fourth or fifth time, it worked. I'm like, okay, what? So it's an unstable exploit, but I got it. And I got the command output. And I'm like, this is like fantastic. About an hour to go before the campaign deadline. Like, wrote the worst report of my life. Like, RCE here, kind of submit and got it in.
Oh, gosh, dude. That's amazing.
And literally, one of the reproduction steps was, you might need to run it 20 to 30 times for it to actually do anything, but it will. Got that in, campaign deadline finished up. And then, obviously, I went back afterwards to try and improve the report because it was in a terrible, terrible state. And then kind of cleaned up the exploit after that. It kind of felt like, I don't know how you were at college or in school, but it felt like a school deadline.
Oh my
or college
gosh.
Deadline, like up all night trying to get it done. Yeah. Finally got it in, like massive relief.
Dude.
Came out of it with a 6K bounty. Certainly not the best bounty of my life, but by the time I was in too deep to back off.
Yeah, man, it seems like it. And it's crazy to me that, because I was just about to say, like, oh, it's good that you have all of these exploits and such in the bag, because it's like, oh, you didn't have any time to develop a new Chromium exploit, right? But actually, that's exactly what you had to do.
Yeah, in that case, I now have like two or three exploits for most of the versions I target on Chrome, just in case. But
yeah,
that was a fun one.
Name something more iconic than Alex Chapman and a Chrome bug.
I know, dude. I know. It's crazy to me that he not only found the XSS in that short time frame and a pretty leet like DOM Purify bypass XSS, but also had to rewrite the whole V8 exploit again.
Yeah.
Absolutely nuts, man. Absolutely nuts. So props to you, Alex. That was pretty crazy. All right. Up next, none other than Mr. Ben Nahomsek himself. Let's see what he's got. All right, man. So it looks like from the doc, we are talking about some of the craziness that happened surrounding 702, where you walked out with the belt and something like six RCEs. So hit me with your favorite bug story.
Honestly, man, I don't think there's a favorite bug story. That entire event was unreal from how it started and how it went. It was just insane. Just, I'll give you a background story. You know, the kickoff calls happened, right? And we all set up the kickoff calls, and like I did last 702 before it solo, showed up solo, and I ended up like top four or top five bounty earners, which was massive, right? You're going massive with like this bag of cash on your shoulder. You go,
dude,
home.
It's great. Yeah.
But there is some cool stuff. I mean, no, I'm not going to cry in a corner with all the cash that I've made, but also like there is a lonely aspect to that, right? Like you're hacking solo. When you're hacking, you know, you know, I'm going against Franz Rosen and Matthias. I'm going against Zishano and Bowman. And then you have P4FG, right? They're just popping random things, right?
Yeah,
like just keeping up. There's a solo aspect of it that I don't enjoy. I really genuinely enjoy hacking with people. And I think when I have somebody, it doesn't have to be like we're splitting everything, but if I was somebody there telling me like, hey, I'm doing this thing, do you want to contribute to it or do you want to look at it together? It really helps you motivated because they're finding things. You can find something based on them. That energy is what I wanted, right? So sure. They announce it's TikTok and Epic. I go, dude, I can't. I hate both of those programs. I go, Justin's going to crush Epic because I know you've been hacking on Epic a lot.
Yep. I go,
I got to compete against someone that already hacks Epic a lot of times. And then it's TikTok, a public program that I've been wanting to hack on, but I never could find anything, dude. I didn't show up to 702 not ever hacking on TikTok. I've done maybe like, I don't know, 30 hours of hacking on TikTok at this point. So I'm like, no bugs found, 30 hours. Fuck it. I'm going to this event. I'm sitting there. Kate the Great, shout out to her. She is, she's talking, you know, we have this call happening. We're going to do this. I'm like doing her spiel. And I go, maybe I just reach out to someone that I wanted to hack with and I hack with them, right? So I look, I go, you and I have hacked before. I go, maybe Joel would be a good one, but I don't know if Joel wants to like wants to grind out that many hours. So I click on the list and Andre is the first one on that list.
Yeah, because the A, we got the A up at the top.
It's a hex, 0x, right?
Oh yeah, okay.
I don't even know if that's why, but it's the first time that I see whatever it is. And I go, I've always joked around with Andre. Our tradition when I was working at Hacker One was he would not tell me, he would put an Eminem song for karaoke, walk up to me and go, we're up in two songs, right? And I go, oh my God, this is meant to be. I got to do this thing. So fast forward, you know, the event happens. And honestly, I don't know what it was, but I don't know if that's how you are, dude. But when an event happens or when I'm just hacking, like I'm in the hacking mode, nothing else. I can't do anything else. I don't want to make content. I lose my daily routine. I go to bed. I fuck up my sleep routine.
Same, dude.
Sorry to your editor if they have to edit my cussing, but
you're good.
I can't do anything. So I'm grinding out these hours, but right off the bat, bam, first day we hit with SSRF, and it's a very outdated component that, I mean, if people have seen it, you know, me, Alex, and Andre went together, and if you know Alex, you know exactly what we found, right?
Yeah. Of course.
We have to walk those lines of what we can talk about.
Right.
Anyhow, so we get those, and I'm like, so we find this first one. I go, Andre, this is our event. We gotta win now. And poor guy, I think I put a little pressure on him. So I'm going to
a lot of momentum though in that.
Yeah, of course, dude.
Yeah.
And I can pull up the text on my phone. I keep telling Kate, how does it feel to talk to the next MVH?
He's calling his shot.
I'm just talking out of my butt, dude. I love the shit talking aspect of like being a competitor, right? It's what drives us. But it's also like shit talking meets manifesting and like pushing yourself, right?
Right. Shit talking meets manifesting, dude. I like that. That's good.
I gotta make that a shirt. But yeah, so that happens, and then Andre's like, "Well, dude, if you want to win, we really got to stop looking at TikTok. Like, we got to focus on the other company, so we can find it." And when we were testing something on TikTok, or I don't know, it was TikTok or it was Epic, I kept jokingly telling Andre, "We're gonna spam an inline RCE into everything we see," and he keeps telling me to like f off. He's like, "No, that's not gonna happen. That's not gonna happen. We're not gonna find a command injection like that or an RCE that easy."
Yeah, that's also what I told you. That's, I can't believe it, man.
So what do you know? We get a, it's not an inline, but it's very similar to the aspect of inlining commands into things, right? We get that. And then Andre's like, I if you don't know Andre, Andre is relentless. If he's, I mean this in the most respectful way, but he's like a dog, dude. He sniffs something and he's not going to let it go.
Yeah.
So he's like, we can pop this shit. And if you know how he talks.
Yeah, I do.
And this is not to mock him. It's just, I love, I've had this like profound, more respect and love for Andre ever since the 702, because he was so relentless. Like, we can pop this.
It's that CTF player mentality, man. All of the guys that come from the CTF realm, it's like you give them something that's kind of sketchy and they just won't let that shit go.
Yeah. So what happens and ends up happening, I'm doing TikTok, he's doing Epic, and we're just talking crap. And like, I kept trying to get inline RC. We're going to get RC. And it works out, man. It was insane. It was, I think we got 2 to 3 RCEs on TikTok, and then we got 2 RCEs on, I wanted to 2 to 3 RCEs on the other one, and then like a couple of highs that were like memory issues, and it's all in the same application. We didn't move on from it. And Joel was there and saw how I just couldn't anymore. I showed up to the event. I was so burnt out that I couldn't do anything, but Andre kept going on the.
I was so pissed, man, because I have spent so much time on this app that you were talking about. And I had even put, command injection payloads in the same section of that application, but not in the exact same spot that you did. Yep. And of course,
So the funny thing is I kept joking with him to do this, and he does it as a joke. And then the root cause was something else. He was overcomplicating it. And it was something that we were just like, this has to be a dupe. And when they got triaged, we're having this moment of like, we're going to get shut down. We're not going to get our belt.
Right.
But this, the moral of the story is, man, I think we had 2 people that really pulled their weight for each app. You know, I really focused on TikTok, and he was helping me with some of the Epic stuff over the TikTok stuff. And then he really owned Epic. And I'm like trying to keep up with him finding other bugs to like balance us out. Yeah. And then you have someone like Alex that's insanely good at what he does. And he's just like, yeah, I already have this export. Let's do it.
Yeah.
And, you know, he helps us out with it. And I think it's just, I don't know. It was so unreal, man. It was such an unreal experience. It's 702. It's 2 bug bounty programs that I've never hacked on, right? If it was like some of the programs that I've hacked on in the past, like an Airbnb or, I don't know, an Amazon or something like that, right?
Yeah.
I would be like, yeah, easy, I could win this. I mean, I don't know if I could beat Sean, but
yeah, dude,
easy, I can beat this, right?
This was an amazing performance for sure. Talking, I guess, more about the technical details of this sort of thing, and as much as we can talk about, because I know that the target is we've talked about what the target is. Would you say that there was a randomness aspect to the payload that you were using there, or was it like really you were just putting this, sort of vanilla command injection payload into a lot of inputs, and the breadth of inputs was the thing that landed you the bug?
I don't think it's the breadth of the input so much. Let me break it down. So there's a couple of aspects when it comes down to like attacking these like massive platforms that it's like it's your Facebook, it's your TikTok, it's your Amazon, it's your just giant, right? The thing that's really interesting is approaching those targets with a business mindset and realizing that these companies, even though they're a social media platform at their core or an e-commerce platform at their core, they attend to businesses more, right? Do you have more functionality for business ads and tracking and APIs than you do as a user? And it's the more functionality it is, the higher it is also the chance of you getting it lower. The higher the work it is, the amount of work you have to get those accounts, right? I don't know if you watched the show until I said, look, I unlocked all these because I have a registered business just for this instance, right?
Yeah. I have and you go through the it. Loops to set up, set yeah. up the scope. And
get I go on the calls. I act like I'm one of. I almost went as far as for one of the bug mining programs. I put out like $50,000 to invest in this thing that they sell you to get access to, right? Because $50,000 is like $3, $4 if I make it back, right?
Exactly.
It's an investment. But to answer your question, it was the setup part of it that, you know, a lot of people were scared of setting up. And it's like, I got to give my social security number. It's TikTok, dude.
Yeah.
Like, I know it's scary to give up your SSN, but they have your information already if you watch TikTok, right?
Yeah.
So there's that aspect of it that we went really, really for getting those business tools that are not hard to do. The other thing is people have access to these tools, but they don't fully execute them. So is it going to cost me $200 to run an ad, for example, or to list an item, to list a house, for example, right? On an Airbnb, you list a house and you got to book it. It's costing you like $20, $30, right? Nobody's going to spend that money to do it unless they see the investment that we do, right?
Right.
Most of our regular bug bounty hunters aren't going to spend $200 to $300 to invest it.
Dang it, dude. All right, fine. I've got this piece of scope that I really want to pay $4,000 to access.
I'll split it with you.
Dude, it's so good. We're gonna let's go. Hold on. Let's cut this. Let's go do it right now. All right, Ben, we see you. Not much of a bug story in there, was
that? more just a winning story.
I'm excited for him, man. That was an MVH he definitely deserves, and they popped some crazy bugs at that event. But obviously, when you talk about the target, you can't talk about the technical details too much, or else it'll you know, you'll give away too much. So
yeah. Gotta keep some secrets, you know.
Gotta keep it tight. All right. Well, props to you, Ben, for that one. And last but not least, we have Mr. Rezo. Let's see what he's got.
So Evan Conley reached out to me. He's another up and coming hacker who's been doing a lot of great bugs lately. And he had a server side template injection in that he could not actually, you know, find something actionable or some sort of impact. And it was because there's, you know, not a lot of data online about it. And then also the functions are kind of esoteric and the format is actually kind of tough to mess with. So anyways, he reached out to me. We noodled on it for a while and we had a breakthrough. I figured out that you could basically fetch content with a function called HTTP get. And then he actually, we ended up reaching out to Shubs, and Shubs showed us that you can do basically an eval, which in this marketing templating language is actually called treat as content. So the payload, we only had like 30 characters or something. And the format's kind of weird. You have to use like, what are those called? The percent symbols to like start and end it. And you have to have the function wrapped in the other function. And so you had to use like a, you know, 4 or 5 character domain. And then you had to use 2 functions. But what's neat is you basically have the payload on your server. Then the HTTP get fetches that in. And then, you know, the eval, which is actually treat as content, executes your, you know, your script or your payload to execute or to exfil the data. And so it was in the title of the email. And so it looks hilarious because there's these like, you know, 10,000 line titles in my email of nothing but user PII at this point.
Dude, that's amazing. Okay. So when it was run through treat as content, was that like sort of double evaluation? Would it become like another template if it was treated as content, or was it really just evaling the AMP script that was coming back from HTTP get?
No, yeah, it had to be a new template. So you would reuse like the templating language again, and then it would execute as a new template. I'm a little surprised so that that's even a part of the language. Yeah. Seemed a little sus, but I'm sure it's out there in other places. I've been told that it's not a default configuration. It has to be like a custom bug introduced by the company that's implementing it. But yeah.
Very cool, man. Very cool. I love that. Yeah. Those scenarios where you have to really like code golf it and you have to get it into such a small little payload. Those are just the most clutch when you finally get like arbitrary execution. Feels so good, dude.
Yeah. Cause you know, there's another world where it never occurred because there was like just one less character you couldn't use or something. Right? It feels perfect.
Exactly.
You're threading the needle.
All right, dude. So that's the bug. And For the listeners there, we're going to wrap the whole bug segment from all of the top hunters. So I hope you guys enjoyed that. And we're going to roll right into something that I'm really excited about, guys. We are launching a new AI plugin called Shift. It's for Kaido. And let me just be clear about this. You know, I think there's a lot of FUD right now in the community about AI plus hacking. Like, oh, some people are like, yeah, no, it's not used here at all. Other people are like, yeah, our jobs are going to be gone in like a year. But I think one of the things that is become abundantly clear to me is that AI can supplement our workflows extremely well as hackers. And there was no clearer representation of this than Cursor, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. When I first got my hands on Cursor and saw what it could do, and how fast it could develop things with you know, even somebody who's relatively familiar with programming at the steering wheel, I was just absolutely amazed. And so I hit Rezo up and I was like, dude, we've got to build this plugin Shift for Kaido, where we can have sort of a similar functionality integrated directly into Kaido itself. So we went down this path and started building it. Obviously, I'm not an AI engineer, so I hit Rezo up. And yeah, I guess Rezo, you want to talk a little bit about your vision for the product and where it's gone?
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, I've been thinking a lot about AI and security for years, mm-hmm. of course. And I do think that, like, so many people just jump straight to the, oh, I'm going to let this AI agent hack everything for me. When in reality, you know, it kind of reminds me of what you just said a minute ago. You said, you know, some people think that AI sucks and can't do anything, or AI is going to take all of our jobs in a year. And, you know, it's going to be somewhere in the middle. And I think Cursor is the perfect example of that, right? It's basically empowering developers to be able to develop things much quicker and take people who aren't even great developers and turning them into great developers by letting them build things they couldn't before. And so, the vision was definitely the Cursor of hacking. When you said that, it just like clicked. Like, that's such a key term, because everyone knows Cursor, at least, you know, everyone who's like staying up on AI stuff. And so it's the perfect tool. You know,
everybody should know Cursor, you know, don't. I've screamed about it from the pod time and time again. So
yes.
If you don't know Cursor at this point, you're doing something wrong. But so we've got a couple segments that we want to talk about here. This product, just to be clear, everybody, this product is still in beta. We are not able to fully release it to everyone yet because we got to build out all the infrastructure and fine tune everything. But we are looking for some beta testers, and we'll link the link to the waitlist down in the description for that. But let's go ahead and talk a little bit about some of those beta features that we've implemented.
Sure.
How about you start with Shift Core, and I'll talk a little bit about memory and rename.
Sweet. Yeah. So Shift Core is basically the main product here. And if you're using Kaido, you know, we're not going to rebuild a proxy from scratch, especially when there's such an amazing proxy that exists already.
Yeah.
So we're integrating with Kaido, and, you know, you'll do your command shortcut and it'll pop up, and it's going to be like a little kind of window that is open in any of the tabs, and it has dynamic content depending on what tab you're in. And it can take dynamic actions in any of those tabs. So obviously we can only support what the Kaido SDK actually supports, but it's a pretty large set of functionality right now already. So it can, you know, it can send requests to replay, it can modify requests, it can send them for you, it can create fuzzing requests via automate, it can set up match replace rules for you. It's pretty quick, and also it's pretty smooth. And when it works, it feels really nice. Like, it has a similar feeling to how Cursor feels, in the sense that it makes you feel like you're moving at the speed of light, you know, at the speed of thought. It's like, do this and it just happens. And so there's, of course, a lot of rough edges and a lot of features we want to add down the road, but it's working really well right now. And so, the Cursor core, or the Shift core, is the bit that does the majority of the lifting of the work.
Yeah. Yeah. And we named it Shift because we have it bound by default to Shift Space. And I don't know. I don't know. We'll see how that goes, Rezo, because like, I don't hit that very often, like on accident, but I do know that some people will, like, they'll be typing and then they'll like try to capitalize something and they'll type a character and then they'll space and it'll pop up. So we'll see if that works for everybody. But of course, the key binding will be rebindable if that doesn't work for you.
That's right.
And yeah, man, I mean, just like you said, I think one of the big things for me with Shift was the fact that you can just seamlessly do things on other tabs of Kaido without it affecting your workflow. So I'm in replay, I'm in HTTP history or whatever, and I see, I need to match and replace that. I can literally just highlight it, pop open the Shift box and say, hey, match and replace this to XYZ. And boom, the match and replace rule is in Kaido built in. It knows exactly where it is in the context, you know, in the response body, or whether it's in a header or wherever. So I think there's a lot of value to that.
I've been using it a lot for, you know, how when you'll sometimes be hacking and you'll find like a specific string, like a function name or an API path, and you really want to just be able to jump to the JavaScript where that is. And, you know, you can open DevTools and search for it or whatever, but you already got Kaido pulled up. And so a lot of times what I'll do is I'll just say, like, show me JavaScript files that have this string in it, and hit enter. And then all of a sudden it sets the HTTPQL and it pops up, and then I just can like start browsing the JavaScript right there immediately.
Yeah. Yeah. It controls the HTTPQL bar. It controls the search bar in Kaido if you want to do it. And it can even navigate you to specific stuff, right? So if you say like, hey, run a search for XYZ, then it will navigate to that page for you in the UI and then populate the HTTPQL bar with what you're looking for as well. So it saves you a click on that end as well. So it's pretty cool. There's definitely some bugs that need to be ironed out. So we built in a feature right off the bat. So for any of you guys that get your hand on it, you know, we're gonna be sending out beta keys sort of in waves moving forward. But for any of you guys that get your hands on it, there is sort of a feedback mechanism built into it where, you know, you can press thumbs up or thumbs down based off of what the AI did. And so we'd really appreciate that additional feedback as you use the plugin.
Why don't you tell them a little bit about how you imagine memory working and how that's going to like speed up like cross user testing and stuff?
Dude, this is great. Okay, so we were kind of sort of brainstorming on the different features for this, and one of the things that was just became abundantly obvious to me is like, wow, this AI really excels with unstructured data. So we built in this feature called memory where you can just select any text throughout Kaido and press like Control Shift M, and it will send that piece of text to Shift's memory. And then whenever you're doing something in the future where you're like, hey, you know, I want to build out this HTTP request, that's one of the features that I'm super excited about with Shift Core is like you can just hand it a JavaScript blob and be like, build the HTTP request body for this. And it will just build out the JSON like perfectly, which is just super, oh, I love that. And what's even better then is if you have the specific IDs, like say you've got a store ID or an organization ID or something like that, if you have that stored in memory, then Shift will know right away to take those values from memory and populate them into the JSON body that you're building, right? So you just paste in a JavaScript blob and then boom, it's got all the IDs, it's got all of the JSON structure and everything pre-formatted and inserted right into the request body for you. So that's the general concept behind memory. And then the last sort of aspect of the product that I think is really cool is Shift Rename. And this is something that I'm just going to be using nonstop, I think, moving forward. Like I'm just never going to go back to having normal replay tabs, which is, and this is something that I've mentioned on the pod before when we finally implemented it, which is this is an automatic replay tab renamer. So if you go into the settings for Shift, there will be like a box where you can freeform describe the instructions on how to name a specific replay tab. So the default one that's in there is start with the HTTP verb and then give a consolidated version of the path. And then I give it an example, right? So then every time a replay tab is created, you can set like a certain offset, like wait 60 seconds or do it right away. The AI will go in there and according to your instructions, analyze the request and then rename the HTTP tab the replay tab according to your instructions. And that just helps so much with staying organized and just being able to access the request that you're looking for as soon as you need it.
Yeah, especially when you go back and you're looking for a specific request or a specific thing that you want to retest or test, that's where it's really going to come in clutch. And like you said, if you're a person who uses a single project to hack across a bunch of different programs, then you might, you know, set those instructions to use the host in the title of the tab. But if you're a person who's hacking the same program the whole time, then you would maybe want to just use the path. So that's fully customizable.
Yeah, 100%. All right, cool. So definitely we've sold them on it, Rezo. So, you know, hope you guys are excited about it as we are. We've been using it in our hacking. It's been really helpful. So I'm excited to see what you all think as well. We've got a website stood up at shiftwaitlist.com. You can go over there, put in your email, join the beta waitlist. And then, as soon as we get everything together and get our infrastructure in place and stuff like that, we're going to start rolling out beta access to it. And the expectation would be, okay, hey, maybe at this point it's not a paid thing, but we need to get your feedback and you need to give us granular feedback on how you would use it and how it's working and how it's not working. And then eventually this is going to be a paid product because obviously we have costs on our side from the AI token consumption. So just gonna throw that out there and preempt all of the people being like, whoa, crazy free AI plugin. Yeah, I mean, we're not gonna put ourselves thousands of dollars in debt in here to run this plugin. So
yeah, and I think it'll make up for the time save for nearly anyone who's using it as well. If it already feels amazing 100%. And really smooth for us. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, 100%. So yeah, I mean, it should just be, you know, in the $20 per month range, depending on how much you use it, I guess. And yeah, dude, I mean, if it saves you 30 minutes, yeah, you know, and it's already saved me 30 minutes, you know, right, like in just a little bit that I've used it, then it should be totally worth your time. So
yeah, and I think it's going to be a killer feature too for Kaido, right? If you haven't tried it out, yeah, it's going to be the perfect time to try out Kaido. And then if you're not super familiar with Kaido, it's great because the AI can actually just navigate and send stuff to places for you, even if you don't know what they're supposed to be named.
Exactly. So. Exactly, man. Yeah. So I'm excited about it. Hope you guys are excited about it as well. And I think that is a wrap on the 100th episode of Critical Thinking. So everybody, thank you so much for, man, I'm going to get emotional here at the end. Thank you so much for 100 episodes of viewership. Y'all have been an amazing community. And thank you for sticking with us for this long episode of Critical Thinking.
Well, right, as one of your biggest fans, one second before you cut off, one of your biggest fans who's probably listened to more episodes than anyone else, from the audience, I'll say thank you to you all for, you know, putting in 2 years worth of heavy work and a lot of episodes and time and effort, blood, sweat, and tears. We've needed a good Bug Bounty podcast for a long, long time, and it's been amazing to get to see you all produce one. So,
dude, my heart. All right, just cut it there. Wow, dude, your email is just constantly getting bombarded with PII after that. That's nuts.
So much PII in my email. I think I need a new email after
that. Yeah, dude. Very cool. Well, that was a great bug. What did you think of the tool that we talked
super
about?
Super cool.
Pretty
super
good, cool. Right?
I know that there's been some AI stuff in Kaido for a little while, but this is like this is next level. So I really enjoyed using Cursor as a product. So I think it'll have really cool implications when added into Kaido in this way. So it should be really cool.
Yeah, man. I think it should be really cool. All right, dude. That's the end. No, Joel, the time has come.
Dun dun dun.
All right, man. Do the honors.
One final. All right.
Yeah.
That's the pod.
Peace, everybody. And that's a wrap on this episode of Critical Thinking. Thanks so much for listening. And if you want more Critical Thinking content, head over to ctbb.show/discord. Join the Discord. There's lots of great conversations and chats going on over there. And if you want to support the show, there's the Discord subscriber tiers, which give you access to masterclasses, AMAs, hackalongs, exclusive scripts, and an exclusive chat channel with us. We'll see you there.